This is In the Circle on D1 Softball.
Gilali with weight, 0-1, lifted to center. Back goes Henry. It's over her head, up against the wall. Caden fires in. Martinez to the plate. It is caught and tagged and out, and Texas wins.
And we welcome you to this edition of In the Circle on D1 Softball. I'm Eric Lopez. Victor Anderson is off. Was calling Stetson softball this whole weekend. And obviously recovering from WrestleMania Night 1 and 2, as well as the Country Music Awards, which are in Austin. I've been told he's getting ready for this big eclipse that's going on Monday event. But have no fear. We got a busy show. Coming up on this show, we're going to have live reports from Austin and Knoxville. You just heard Andrew Haynes, the radio voice of the Texas Longhorns, calling the Saturday night thriller between Texas and Oklahoma. Texas winning the series against Oklahoma. That is something we've never said in the history of this show, and we've been on for over 800 episodes, nearly a decade. We'll talk to Justin McLeod, who's going to join us momentarily from Austin, Texas, who covered the series. Hope later on to be talk Tennessee, Georgia, with Rianne Potke, who was in Knoxville covering that big SEC series. And then later on, we're going to air an interview I had with Joey Lott and talk about the mental aspect of softball and what she's up to now, the former bronze medalist for the Canadian national team in the Olympics in 2021, former Bucknell head coach, will join us. All coming up here on In the Circle on D1 Softball. Follow us on all the social media platforms. Make sure you follow D1 Softball. Make sure you follow, of course, Jenna Becerra and Amanda Lorenz. They got the D1 Softball podcast this coming week. Boy, they got a lot to talk about, just like we do on this show. All right, let's not waste any more time. Let's join the man from Austin. I'm not sure if he's there, going to stick around for the Country Music Awards shows as we talk, or the Eclipse. Maybe he is. Apparently everybody is. Big hotel. But he was there covering the series of the year that we've been anticipating for weeks. Texas and Oklahoma, first top five showdown in this rivalry's history in Austin, and it's the Longhorns winning the series 2 out of 3. OU won the first game 5-2. Texas wins Saturday night, Sunday night, 2-1 games, and the man that saw it all is D1 Softball's very own, Justin McLeod. So I guess the question, are you there sticking around for the Eclipse? What are we doing?
You know, I don't think so. I've got places to be and people to see. So I think the three games of softball was the highlight of Austin for me anyway. Wow. So now that the good part's done, why would I stick around for a measly old Eclipse or a measly old award show?
Nah, no need. No need. You got plenty. As we did recording this, you just got out of the post-game press conference. Obviously huge. First time Texas has won a series against Oklahoma since 2009. First time Oklahoma has lost a Big 12 series since 2011. To tell you how long ago that was back in the day when the Big 12 played a bunch of two-game series because they had a larger conference. And then you had teams like Missouri and A&M, I believe, were still in the conference back then. And Nebraska, I believe. A little different time back then. Or at least there was a lot of teams in the Big 12 back then. So, Justin, I know it's just you're just coming out of the postgame here momentarily. Give me your reaction here to something we haven't seen in a long time, which is Oklahoma losing a series. And I think, to me, where the credit should go is Texas. Because we said before this series, we knew Texas had made up ground to Oklahoma, but we would find out how much, if any, how much they did make up. And, boy, I think they made up some good ground on OU, and I think we got a compelling next month ahead of us.
I think you're exactly right. That's the thing. You know, I think there's going to be a lot of people who see this as doomsday for Oklahoma. I don't think that's the case, but I also don't think that's fair to Texas because Texas, it's not a flash in the pan. It's not, as we used to say in the South, a blind hog grabbing an acorn. Like, Texas has built up their program and built up their team to win series like this. And so I think the credit belongs to Texas before anything else goes anywhere else. The credit belongs to Texas because of how they built this program up, what that team looks like. This was a hard-fought series. All three games, hard-fought series. You had Oklahoma, who, you know, scored two runs on Friday night. Jada Coleman hits a three-run home run. It's 5-0. It's like, okay, what's going to happen? Then Texas claws back in the bottom of the seventh, scores two runs. Finals 5-2. After the Coleman home run, it was never in doubt that Oklahoma was going to win. But you had a good game. You had a good 5-0 game. Then you go to Saturday, it's 2-1. If not for a leaving early call, a correct leaving early call, don't get me wrong. But if not for that, it would have been 4-1. But it's 2-1 is the final on Saturday night. And then on Sunday today, you've got another 2-1 game. This was a hard-fought series. 21 really solid innings of softball. And I think you're right. I think the credit absolutely belongs to Texas before anything else goes anywhere else, because it was Texas that won this series. This was not Oklahoma lost the series. This was Texas won this series. And they did it. It was pretty darn impressive.
Texas is pitching, obviously, a big story there. Satali Gutierrez was magnificent on Saturday night. And then Teagan Kavan, the freshman. You and I argued about this after the Saturday night game on who would get the ball to start the game. You thought it'd be Estelle Check. I said Kavan. It turns out we're technically both right because they both got the ball. But they both were magnificent. Only the Ella Parker home run was the damage there. What did you see from the Texas pitching staff that was able to control this Oklahoma offense?
I think they played their depth to perfection. Give credit to Mike White, give credit to Patty Ruth Taylor, whoever it belongs to. Maybe it's the coaching staff as a whole. But throughout the weekend, I thought they played the pitching staff really, really well. You look at, I think everybody probably expected Teagan Kavan to start. Maybe they expected her to start game one. She didn't. And so that was Mack Morgan, who was decent, solid. Estelle Check in relief. Solid. Sitlali Gutierrez, sensational on Saturday night. Then you get Kavan in game three on Sunday. And truth be told, that surprised me the most, that Kavan got the start in game three. But it worked to perfection. And Estelle Check came in relief, three hits and a strikeout. 3.1 innings of work. That's hard to do. I think Texas played matchups really well. I think they used Check and her dominance of left-handed hitters excellently. And I think also, I think there's something to be said for trusting their pitchers. You did not have a quick hook. Now, today, or on Sunday, I guess, Teagan Kavan comes out with a runner on first and two outs, and you're like, okay, well, not really in any danger. It was very clearly a plan. It was a plan. So there was not a quick hook. They were willing to trust their pitchers. Gutierrez, seven innings on Saturday night. A pitcher going seven innings against what this Oklahoma offense has been known to do is tough. That doesn't happen often. And here Gutierrez is going seven innings on Saturday. So I think the thing that worked the best for Texas was how they managed the entire staff. They managed their strengths. They played to their strengths. And they trusted their pitchers. And I think every single one of those pitchers upheld that trust.
Obviously, it was such a big series that they kind of, Texas set it up to be more of a regional type setting. Justin has been posting this on his Twitter, and obviously you've seen this on D1 Softball, obviously. So the teams are basically, it's like a press conference, like if you would see on a regional or a super regional. So I'm curious, give me your thoughts. What was the reaction from the Oklahoma side, from Patty Gasso and the players over the last 2 days here? Suffering, doing, going through something they haven't gone through in a regular season conference series in over a decade. The last time they lost two games in a row, most recently in general, I think was maybe what, the 2019 National Championship Series against UCLA. Maybe they lost, I'm sure they lost, maybe they lost, you know, that's, it's been a while. They're not used to this. What did they have to say about this series?
You could certainly tell that it was uncharted territory to a certain extent. I'll give them credit. Gasso, the players, you didn't have super downtrodden people wearing OU uniforms, at least not in the press conference. And Patty Gasso even said, and I'm paraphrasing, it's not a direct quote, but to the effect of, we're not broken and we're not saddened. This just, it's basically, she was saying it was a bump in the road. And I think that's true. Oklahoma's, it's not like Oklahoma is suddenly a bad team. What have we learned this weekend? They're mortal. And I don't think that really is a surprise to anyone. They are mortal, but that's really all that's there. So, I mean, I think it was a completely fair reaction. A little bit of uncharted territory, certainly for the players, but for Paddy Gasso and even the players in large part, it's just a bump in the road. There's plenty of softball left. OU is still on top of the Big 12 standings. So, I mean, I didn't see, honestly, I didn't really feel like I was seeing a lot of sadness there, which you might have expected after losing a series like this. I didn't feel like I saw a lot of, like I said, not really any downtrodden faces type of deal. It was, you know, not necessarily fun to lose twice. Little uncharted territory, but I think their reactions were what you would expect from a team that's as veteran as OU is, and also a team that knows that two losses do not mark the end of their season. I can't say Paddy Gasso was exuding hopefulness, but she certainly was not exuding hopelessness. I think it was you take a couple of losses on the chin, a couple of tight games, you have to learn from your mistakes, and then you move on to the next series. And I think that's a completely appropriate place to be.
Texas, obviously, huge series win for Mike White in Texas. What did they have to say?
Well, Mike White, you know, I've been impressed with him in press conferences this year. He's always been a good speaker, don't get me wrong. But he's been really good this year about straight shooting his team straight. Talking about his team straight, because I think Mike White knows, but obviously he knows better than anyone, but I think he understands what his team is capable of this year. He was excited. I'm not even going to say he was ecstatic, because again, similar to Gasso, Mike White knows there's a lot of season left. He knows that even this win, they're still sitting right now in third place in the Big 12 by a game or so. So he knows there's a lot of games left to play. It was actually kind of funny towards the end of the Texas press conference on Sunday after game three. He mentioned, you know, take a little time to enjoy this one and then it's on to Baylor. And one of the reporters kind of, you know, just kind of jokingly was like, do they get, you know, extra days off to celebrate one like this? And he goes, no, just one day off. He goes, they got 2 days off last week. And he said it with a smile on his face, and everybody in the room laughed, including the players and including Mike White. But I do think that's indicative. You know, this is big for Texas. This is something that hasn't happened in over a decade, like you've mentioned. This is something that the last time this happened, Mike White was not even coaching Oregon at that point. So I think that's the gravity of this series win for Texas is not lost on anyone, the importance of it. But I think Texas, much like Oklahoma, understands there's a bigger picture. And I think that's a sign of a really good team when they do understand and acknowledge that bigger picture. It's okay if Oklahoma doesn't like losing. It's okay if Texas celebrates winning. But I think both teams really understand this is one series. This is three games in the mix of a lot of other games. And the ones that leave you hoisting a trophy are still to come.
I think that's fair for them. But that doesn't mean we can't go ahead and look big picture here. Couple things here, and then we're going to get into the Saturday game because there was a couple of obviously calls that got a lot of people talking after that game. First of all, a big shame that this game, no disrespect to the network. I watch Longhorn Network. I enjoy some of the content they have there. This game should not have been on Longhorn Network. It's a travesty this game was on Longhorn Network. This game should have been on ESPN or ESPN2. I understand that ESPN wants to do the simulcast of the women's basketball national title game with Iowa, South Carolina. Spoiler! South Carolina won again! Wow! What a shocker! Predictable. Nonsense. Anyway, you can tell I'm not a women's basketball person. As far as, you know, the predictability of it, I know I'll get some backlash on that. That's okay. So they did the whole Taurasi Bird Manning Cast wannabe show on ESPN. Why? This game should have been on ESPN2. It should have been on ESPN2. These are two of the best teams, and that's disappointing from the game. So I just want to get that out of the way. Big picture here. We do not have, as we record this, I don't have the official RPI numbers, but I do know in checking some stuff. There's a good chance Texas will be number one RPI. I think the number one national seed is open now. It's open. I think Texas has a shot at the one seed. I think Oklahoma clearly still has a shot and might still be the favorites to get the one seed. And I think Stanford has a shot to be the one seed here in the next month or so. I haven't decided what I'm going to do when my next bracketology on that. I got to look at all the metrics and all that when it kind of finalizes itself. But I think that's open, Justin. And I do think this series establishes Texas, which I felt coming when they came to Orlando and seen them in person and we had Andrew Haynes on the show. I felt this is a national title contender. I think they've established that. And I think those three teams I just mentioned are, to me now, the three favorites for the national title. I understand critics will point at Stanford's offense as a question mark. I agree. But in my opinion, they have the best player in the sport that can negate, can make up for that, possibly. But I think this is open now for the next month. Again, if I had to bet money, if you ask me today who I think will end up being the one seed on Selection Sunday, I think it'll be Oklahoma if they take care of business. But I think the question is there, which we haven't quite frankly had in a couple years.
No, you're right. And the question is there. And I use a phrase I used earlier. Oklahoma has now proven that they are immortal. At the end of the day, even though, you know, RPI and things like that are based on the current year, Oklahoma coming off three straight national championships was always going to be number one unless they proved they were mortal, unless somebody made them prove or proved they were mortal, however the proper grammar is. It's been a long weekend. I do think that the question mark is fair there, because this Oklahoma team has not been as dominant as the Oklahoma teams in the past. They haven't been. And after this weekend, I still have significant questions about the pitching staff for the Sooners. That said, until somebody beat them, until and unless somebody beat them, Oklahoma was number one. They were going to stay number one. Now somebody has beaten them. So it does make for an interesting question. And one team I'll throw in that I think has a shot at, you know, World Series contention and, you know, maybe doing some things is Oklahoma State. They're on the back of one arm, primarily in Lexi Kilfoyle, but they're a scrappy team. You just remember, they just took a series from the same Texas team that just beat Oklahoma, and Bedlam's still to go. So that series is going to be pretty crucial in that category, because now Oklahoma has proven they're mortal. Oklahoma State has beaten Oklahoma a couple of times in the last few years. They're a World Series stalwart themselves. But yes, I mean, the question mark is appropriate there. If Texas jumps to number one in RPI, it's earned. It's absolutely earned. I feel like they're probably going to be number one across the board in terms of the rankings this week, if I had to bet. Again, it's not kicking dirt on Oklahoma's grave. Oklahoma's far from the grave. But yes, it has big implications and big things for Texas, because, I mean, you're talking about, even if Texas slips up and, say, loses a game to Baylor because they're still riding this Oklahoma high, after winning these two games, even a loss is not a disqualifier for Texas being number one. That's how big a deal this is for the Longhorn.
I 100% agree. I think it's very wide open in that regard, and like I said, it should be interesting to see how that plays itself out. And I think the other thing, you mentioned Kilfoyle and Oak State. Texas now showed you how to pitch to Oklahoma. How many, you know, that's why I think Stanford, if you're Stanford, you're feeling much more confident because you've got the pitcher who could shut down Oklahoma. Maybe Oklahoma State getting a little confidence with that. That being said, again, I still think Oklahoma is the favorite. But I don't, the gap has been narrowed, and it makes it compelling. And I think that's a good thing for the game in the big picture. To say the least. And I'd say this, I think Maxwell pitched very well. If you're Oklahoma, the positives is Kelly Maxwell pitched very well, I thought, Friday night and even Sunday. Gave you a chance to win. Like, I don't think OU, I think the thing that's going to be perplexing from Oklahoma, if you would have told them they gave up two runs, basically a game to Texas, they're thinking, oh, we swept them. So really, I'll defend OU. I thought OU's pitching was good against that Texas offense. I think the stunning part is that OU's offense was shut down. Ella Parker hit the home run there, but they missed the opportunity with runner on base, and I think that's something we're not used to, because even when Louisiana beat them, That was more of OU missed some plays defensively, and it was more of an offensive type of style of a game. I don't know if people thought, well, you're gonna, you know, can you score on OU, and what happens if it's a pitching duel? Well, you got beaten on two pitching duels here the last 2 days. So I think it was very fascinating from that standpoint.
Well, Texas had a perfect game plan. My questions for Oklahoma's pitching staff certainly go back to Saturday when I was unimpressed with everybody not named Nicole May. And Nicole May was solid. But again, we go back to the mortality thing. And for Kelly Maxwell, here's the thing. Kelly Maxwell has re-proven herself as one of the best pitchers in the country. But Sunday's game was the first time this season that Maxwell has started two games against a conference opponent. And Texas hit her. Now, they hit her. She gave up three hits. She got six strikeouts. It's not like she had a bad out.
No, not at all. And I think she looks better than she did at any last year. I think she looks better. I think that's an encouraging thing. I wasn't sure if she would be better than she was. You know, last year, I don't think she was at the level that she was a couple of years ago. But she does look a lot better than she did last year. I think that's good news if you're Oklahoma, because you're right. I do agree with you this. She is going to be the one that's going to have to carry, I think, the staff in the points we get to the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was a conversation on Press Row. We were discussing that before the game. You know, when it comes to the Women's College World Series, OU is going to have to throw Maxwell every other day at minimum. Like, you know, they throw in an off day in there because of a winner's bracket or whatever, but they're going to have to throw Maxwell frequently because you have Nicole May, but you don't have anything behind it. Carly Keeney has done best in a relief role, kind of stop the bleeding. I'm going to tell you, I was not impressed with the back end of the bullpen. I really didn't love how Kirsten Deal looked this weekend. And then Peyton Monticelli in a couple of batter appearance on Saturday. Really unimpressed there. She's got great velocity. That's about it. So that's interesting to me on the Maxwell front, just because this is the first time she's done this. She still looked really doggone good. But at the end of the day, it was one of those things where what happens when this the fourth time?
I got to see what the matchups are in OKC also. I mean, that's a factor. It's hard to say. Well, she has to – I don't know if she has to throw. I don't know if I agree with that. Because, again, what's the situation? Do you have to beat them twice in one day? Things like that could make a big – what's the – who are you playing, right? And things like that. And let's be real. I mean, more than likely, Oklahoma in the tournament will be playing in the state of Oklahoma, a little different than Austin, Texas. Just say. Although maybe the horn guy maybe will go with the Oklahoma. What the heck, Justin? The horn guy. That's all – we were talking about on the broadcast. People are talking about. I'm texting people like, "Where the hell is that coming from?" And then they showed the guy on the broadcast. I mean, he's outside the stadium, as I understand it. So therefore, nobody can really stop him from blowing the horn.
It is city of Austin property, so the University of Texas doesn't have jurisdiction over. That's the explanation I was given. I would love for that horn to not exist. Let me tell you,
because I think everybody agrees. I think everybody would agree. It reminded me like of the Whistler. If you're a college baseball fan, the Vanderbilt has a fan of the Whistler, where the guy.
Now, I will say, for Mia Scott whistling from the Texas dugout, she didn't do it a ton this weekend. She did it some, but it's so different.
Oh, listen, I don't have an issue with.
So different.
It was funny because people tip me to that, like, "Hey, watch out for the Scott Whistler." And I'm like, I never noticed it when Texas played UCF. So that part I don't care about. The horn thing is clear and obvious on the broadcast, and it is annoying. Like, the Vanderbilt guy in baseball is annoying. Like, one of the reasons why I'm happy that Vanderbilt doesn't have softball is because I don't want that Whistler guy to be at a softball game because he drives me nuts. But that's a whole other story another time. Let's get into Saturday here, a couple things here. Because you got to get going on the road. You're trying to, beat the rush here.
Places to be and people to see, and the eclipse is not on that list.
No, it's not. That's got to change Justin's plans, traveling plans a little bit. But anyway, Saturday night, we played the Open with Andrew Haynes. Wild finish there. But I want to start in the sixth inning. You mentioned it. The ball, Stewart hits, bases loaded, gets two runs in. Oklahoma challenges, runner leaving early. Turns out was correct. The runner at second left early. It wipes it off the scoreboard, the score. And it was a right call, right challenge. Okay, so let me just emphasize that. The right good idea to challenge. You have the right to review it. She did leave early. Don't leave early. That's what coaches are telling you and all that. That being said, Justin, because I've seen this at games I've been calling. I've seen this at games that are going on. And here's my issue, Justin. You and I talked to a lot of people, higher-ups in softball before the year. What was one of the big mandates they kept emphasizing? The pitch clock. Why? Why did they put the pitch clock and emphasize that this year? What's the goal there?
Speeding up the game.
What is this reviews of these relieving runners early doing, Justin? It's not speeding up the game.
Well, I think Mike White said it really well on Saturday night because he was on the rules committee.
Yeah.
And
a little while ago, right? Not recently, but yeah.
Again, I'm paraphrasing. Well, he was on there when this came in.
Oh, was it? Okay.
And I'm paraphrasing his thoughts, but it was to the effect of the idea of the review, what was to stop a runner from leaving early on a stolen base. And we have to admit, you know, there were a couple of things last year that you know, probably heightened the urgency to implement that piece of it. You know, some incidents that happened in the sense of, you know, a runner being called leaving early and negating a hit, things like that. We all know. I think the biggest thing for me is the way it's been set up and the way it's being used is to negate major plays. Your pitcher misses a pitch, gives up a big hit. Oh, well, I want to challenge that the runner left early. And a lot of times they did. And don't get me wrong, the simplest solution, just don't leave early. Just leave on time. Practice it for a week or 2 weeks. Like, practice leaving on time instead of one round of batting practice on Wednesday. You know, things like that to get it right if you don't want this to happen. But, yes, it's not being done as intended. I'll say that. But it's being done within the rules. The challenge and everything else is being done within the rules. It's not speeding up the game. And one thing I will say that I think would be completely appropriate is simply, if you can't see it on, you know, within the first minute and a half of the review, call stands. Like, I think something as simple as that from a replay guidance, it would be effective. Because the kicker is, if I have to watch a replay 17 times to see whether or not a player's foot is off the bag, can you fit an index card, going back to the old NFL, you know, first down marker, can I fit an index card between her foot and the base? If I have to get down to that degree, that's not what it's intended to do. It's being used, unfortunately, it's being used completely appropriately within the rules.
I don't blame coaches, by the way. I do not blame coaches because you're right. I don't think this was the way it was intended to be used, but yeah. I don't blame coaches for doing it. That's in their own right. I have no issues with that. You've allowed this to happen.
Right.
But my issue with this is now it's getting to the point where we're taking 5 minutes. Like, yeah. Full disclosure. Okay. Let's just pull away from OU Texas here because believe it or not, folks, there were other softball played. I called UCF BYU on Saturday. There was a call on Ilana. UCF challenged Ilana Agbayani for leaving early in the first inning, running for first. They said she did. When they reviewed it, took a few minutes. They overturned it. They said, yes, she did leave early, which I'll be honest, I didn't think was conclusive enough from what I saw. There were a couple calls that were overturned in that series later on that I didn't think was conclusive enough that they overturn it. I remember you messaged me when that happened because you happened to be watching that. You were stunned that they overturned.
Yeah, I didn't even think she left early to begin with, much less conclusive to overturn.
Well, that's the problem. That the other issue I have is we were told, and these it's got to be conclusive to change a call. And I don't know what conclusive is anymore because I've seen more get called there. So, and you know, we did an episode earlier this year. It was the weekend of the Arkansas Mississippi State, where Arkansas, their freshman talented catcher, hits the home run, but Nia Carter left early, and they wiped out the home run together. And I just, It has no impact on the home run. I know there's a big debate, well, it's a dead ball near that. I made this comparison on the broadcast this weekend. It reminds me of what the National Football League did one year where they decided, hey, let's go instant replay on pass interference. Because there was that whole controversy with a playoff game where there was not a pass interference call and it was blatant and all that. But what they found was it took up a lot of time to review it. And, oh, by the way, it's a judgment call. And a lot of times they didn't overturn it because, well, if the ref thought it was pass, I'm just going to go with it. So everybody felt we're wasting time here. And so they just got rid of that after a year. I know there's difference. It's apples and oranges. But, Justin, I'm telling you, as a casual fan, it is a turnoff. People are going to click the channel away from this. And I don't want people – I just – my thing is don't blame the players and put them on mandate pitch clocks when there are other things that are the reason why the games are going longer. That's all I'm saying.
Well, I don't have any issue with the reviews. I don't actually have much of an issue with leaving early even being reviewable. I don't like the way it's being done. And coaches are using it as they're allowed within the rules. I don't like the way it's being used to basically change plays where it was not, where leaving early didn't have an effect. I don't like that aspect of it, but I actually don't mind the aspect of it being reviewable and things like that. You're right that it's not great for casual fan, especially because it's an obscure rule that a casual sports fan is not going to understand. That to me is the biggest thing. If that's going to be such a big thing, we've got to do a better job of, because I'll tell you, I watch a lot of softball games. I know that's a shock to you and everyone listening.
You don't
I watch
say.
A heck of a
yeah,
lot of softball games. There are a lot of people who even broadcast softball games who don't understand that rule. And if the people – I'm going to tell you right now, there's also some people who coach a lot of softball games who don't understand that rule, but that's another story. But from the rule perspective, that's the only hang-up I have, or the main hang-up I have, is – it's not explained well. It is obscure. And if we don't recognize that, that to me is where you're going to lose casual viewers the most. Because if I tune in and they're standing there on replay review, even if I'm listening to the broadcast commentators talk about it, it doesn't mean it's explaining it to me. If I just a casual softball watcher,
it's not an easy thing to explain. Right.
It's not. And it's different from baseball. Which I think normally I avoid baseball versus softball comparisons, but I do think it's key here because the automatic thing that we've all been used to for 100 years since Abner Doubleday or whatever the heck his name was, you know, invented baseball. We're used to a certain set of rules. We all grew up watching baseball as kids. This is a different rule in softball, and explaining it to a casual sports fan is, to your point, my hang-up. I don't actually mind the replay aspect. I don't even mind the slower aspects of it. That, to me, is the biggest issue because that's where I think you're going to lose casual fans. That said, I also think a little more universal definition of conclusive would be good. I think a time limit on how long you review a leaving early would be good. But at the same time, I'm not going to lie, I find it really – it's not coincidental. It's not funny. Those are the only two words coming to mind. But I don't think it's an accident that Katie Stewart, Texas's freshman first baseman, is the player who hit the 2 RBI double that got called back on the leaving early on Saturday night and then comes in on Sunday and hits a 2-run home run that proves to be the difference in the game. Yeah. I don't know if you ever heard the phrase, ball don't lie.
Right.
Oh, that's good. Might be the case of ball don't lie.
No, that's fair. I agree, and I think you make some good points there. And I think, let me just say this, I'm pro-replay. I don't care if the game goes 3 hours long. I just don't want to hear people complain about the length of game when this is the real reason games go longer. It's not because a pitcher is taking 21 seconds to throw a pitch.
The only people complaining about games length is TV people. I understand why they are, but they are because their vested interest is first and foremost is for television. I don't blame them for it. But that's really only people who's complaining about the games being too long. Let's just get the elephant out of the room.
I agree. Well, and I'll say this. Baseball does a good job with their replay. It's clean. It's quick, efficient. I've called college baseball. It's quick. Softball's got to get to that point where it's quick and efficient. I understand there's a lot of angles. I think the SEC does a really good job of this. And you've told me about this. I think that's the way to do it. Personally,
it is, but you got to make more conferences care enough to do it. Like, the fact that the SEC has their control center, they have the centralized replay. It's not each school. Like, there are some schools that have one screen off to the side, and you go in and you just see what you see. There are some schools that have an iPad where you go in and you just – and I'm sorry, but you can't see anything on an iPad. So there's not even uniformity in how replays are done. I think we have to start at uniformity in our definitions of conclusive, in our how long are we taking to review thing, but also in what equipment do we have? What's the standard? The standard for a replay review should not be just have a screen to watch it on. Because I'm sorry, I can watch a replay on my phone. Doesn't mean it's doing me any good.
Let me go a step further. I think the other thing they got to do is mic up the ump. And the SEC does do this. But if you're a fan in attendance and you see all of a sudden a challenge and then you're like, think about it. If you're a casual fan in attendance, you're asked, what's going on here? What? Like, why are they to overturn that? Why is she out all of a sudden? I thought she was safe. You know what I mean? I just think baseball does a better job of this stuff. And I think we're learning, but sometimes when you add too many things, you make it more complicated. And I think this could be also – I want to kind of tag this with obstruction because that was the call at the end that there was no obstruction. OU thought there was obstruction. I thought Beth Mowins, Mendoza, and Smith, if you watched the telecast – I know you were there, so you didn't have to. But I thought they did a great job explaining why that was not obstruction at all, which I was happy about, and that Atwood did nothing wrong. And she made a great play there as a catcher there on that final play. Great throw by Henry, the freshman. But I thought that was a great play, and I hope, to me, credit to Mowins, Mendoza, and Smith. I think that clip of them explaining the obstruction rule should be applied and used at every game, at every meeting, television meeting, production meetings, whatever you want to describe it. Applause to the three of them for really breaking that down perfectly. If you watched the telecast, you felt very comfortable with the call on the field, in my opinion, Justin. What was it from in person? What was the talk afterwards about that play?
Well, for starters, those of us on press row were already down in the bullpen by then. So my view of the live action was a little obscured. I think, actually, having now seen the videos and heard the explanation, I do think it was a really quality explanation, and I agree with you, that's super key for the TV commentators to be able to explain it like that, which, I mean, we're talking about Mowins, Mendoza, and Smith, so it's like, that's the crew that should be able to explain it above all else, and they did. They really did a nice job. I think, too, the obstruction rule and the tweaks in that rule to allow a catcher to grab the ball and go into the path of the runner was a super key element of that, because that's not always been the case. People are so conditioned to, well, the runner has to have a path to the bag, and if the bag is blocked, this thing. They're so conditioned to what obstruction has been since it was an emphasis a few years ago, and now that's been tweaked. So I actually think it was a really good primer for what the obstruction rule is and is not. I thought it was a perfectly called play by the umpiring crew, and I think it was appropriately upheld on replay. I think for me, we talk about obstruction a lot, but I think if that kind of a play is called obstruction, that's when you get truly into the, okay, now this is an issue. So I think it was really – really well done defensively by Henry. I mean, Martinez was a little off, but for Atwood to grab it and to hang on to it after a hit like that, just insanely good defense. And then I think, too, the umpires got it exactly right. I mean, give credit where credit's due. It was upheld on replay. But for Robert Gonzalez, the home plate umpire on Saturday night, his positioning and his call were stellar.
Agreed.
He didn't hesitate. As soon as he knew that Atwood held on to the ball, he had the out. He had the punch out. And that's the right call, and it was upheld. So credit Robert Gonzalez and the umpiring crew in that sense, because, you know, it's one thing to be upheld on replay, but remember, to be upheld on replay, the call's got to be made right on the field. So I'll give him credit for that one especially. But I thought it was really well explained on the broadcast. And I think people that didn't necessarily know beforehand got an understanding now of what the obstruction rule is and is not. And I think that's going to come into play pretty handily down the road.
I hope. I mean, that was good. Well done by everybody on that. That was great execution on that play. An amazing finish on that game. I mean, that might be the finish of the year. Yeah. And that's why I played, and I played the Andrew Haynes call at the Open because I thought that was a fantastic. I don't know, Justin, if Golden Mikes brings back the call of the year, that would be a nominee, would be Andrew Haynes' call, that one, because that was pretty awesome. Right. Anyway, last thing before we let you go, so you got to hit the road, is what's next for these two teams? What are you looking forward to seeing about these two teams?
Well, I think it's the same thing, but from opposite sides. I want to see what they do next. For Texas, you know, how much does this high affect them? I mean, you know, they've got Texas State in the midweek, then they have Baylor. Those are games that are not going to be easy. How do they respond?
The hangover. Is there a hangover? Yeah.
If they are the number one team in the country, as I expect them to be this week, that will happen right before they play Texas State and a few days before they play Baylor. How do they respond to now being the hunted instead of the hunters? For Oklahoma, how do they respond to the loss? Like, you have to think, this group of players is not used to losing. Just flat out, they're not used to losing. How do they respond to losing? Do they come out firing to prove that they're still the number one team in the country? To show people, hey, this is why we were number one, remember. Or do they have a hangover of their own? Do they struggle with responding to losing? On both sides, it can go either way. And I think how both teams respond to their respective happenings this weekend will set up the latter month of the season. Texas has already played Oklahoma State and now Oklahoma. Oklahoma still has to play Oklahoma State, the three best teams in the Big 12, the whole round-robin deal. And now Texas, if they trip up the rest of the way, it's going to be to someone outside of that top three. They've already tripped up against Oklahoma State. They rebounded perfectly against Oklahoma, took the series. If they trip up the rest of the way, it's going to be because they look too far ahead or because –
Well, the example is the Houston game. The example is when they lost to Houston, the opening Big 12 game, because they were just voted number one, including us here at D1 Softball, voted him number one, which was fair at the time. But there was, I think they did, you know, they kind of got a little excited there. And then Houston brought their Super Bowl. Well, that was their Super Bowl. And they lost the Slugfest 12-10, which, you know, that was not a deal there. You're right. That, you know, do we see that here now? Or did they learn from that experience earlier in that year?
Well, and for Oklahoma, similarly, like they're now likely, I'm not going to say for sure, but likely not going to be number one. And it's not going to be just because, oh, well, we lost a random game on a weekend and Texas stayed winning. Like, it's going to be an earned 2-3, whatever spot they fall to. Again, Oklahoma traditionally, after single losses that they've had, the few of them they had the last few years, they tend to respond with a vengeance. We don't know. Let's just – and Oklahoma fans, hear me. We do not know how Oklahoma responds to losing a weekend series because it hasn't happened in recent memory. This group, it hasn't happened. So how they respond will be super, super key because you're in uncharted territory. Still a very good Oklahoma team, but a very good Oklahoma team in uncharted territory. And so how both teams respond right away but also through the next month, to me, is the biggest thing that I'm really curious to see coming off this series. Because it could go one of a couple of different directions on both sides.
They have, I believe, Wichita State. They're scheduled to play midweek, BYU. So I think the good news there is I would not want to be BYU. Let me just say that. I think that could be a tough weekend for Coach Eakin and BYU against OU. And then I believe after that series – Oklahoma has, well, they've already played Kansas. They've already played Texas Tech. They have UCF at the end of the month, but I know they have a series before UCF as I quickly scramble to look at it. Oh, yes, Houston. Hello. My point is, I think the schedule actually, I think Oklahoma is going to be fine. I think they're going to be fine. They should.
I think they're going to be fine.
Yeah.
But I am curious to see how they come out.
Sure, sure. How do they come out? Do they come out guns a blazing? Do they put up a football score, or do they have a hangover themselves? Right, it's fair.
To be fair, I don't think Oklahoma's going to lose before Bedlam. I'll just throw that out there into the ether. And I'm not saying they're going to lose in Bedlam, but until then, I'm comfortable saying I don't think they're going to lose before then.
Right. I got what you're saying.
But I want to see how Oklahoma plays leading up to that point. I want to see how they come out against BYU. I want to see how they play Wichita. I want to see how they play Houston and UCF. Like, I want to see what Oklahoma looks like, even in the course of winning games that I expect them to win. That, to me, is going to be the piece that tells me more than a win-loss result does. And the same with Texas. I'm less concerned with, is Texas going to come out and lose games or win games? I want to see how they play after this. Do they still play with a little bit of a chip on their shoulder? Do they still play the calm, collected way they played this weekend for the most part? Or do they, does it go the other direction? So it's more in the style of play next weekend and the rest of the way that I'm more curious than I am win-loss results.
That's Justin McLeod in Austin, Texas, reporting on the OU Texas series for D1 Softball. Folks, in the circle here on D1 Softball, but nothing changes. Me and Justin, I told him I'd only be 15, 20 minutes. Of course, we blow past that, like usual. What else is new?
What is time, anyway?
Well, hopefully you beat out the eclipse. I know you're trying to beat the race to your next trip, which I'll let you announce that later. We don't even have time to get into where you're going because you've got an interesting game you're going to be covering later this week in the midweek up in Ruston, Louisiana. But I'll let you – that's another time for another show. Justin, thanks for the reporting. Check out D1 Softball just as a recap of all the what happened, transpired in Austin, Texas, OU, Texas coverage. Check them out on social media and everything. Sir, good reporting out there from Austin. It's funny, you mentioned you want to see how Oklahoma looks. I'll see them in a few weeks in Orlando, so I'll give you a live report from there at that point. But, hey, thanks for checking in on us.
Yep, appreciate it.
All right, coming up, we're not done, though, folks. We got a hell of a great staff here on D1 Softball. When we come back, we're going to go over to Knoxville, a little SEC talk. Rand Podke covering Tennessee series win over Georgia. What was her impression? She broke some news during that series of a marquee player being hurt. We'll discuss all of that and much more. Then later on, you'll hear my interview with Joy Lai on the mental side of the game of softball and much more. You're listening and maybe watching In the Circle on D1 Softball.
I interrupt that untruthful statement in the open from Eric Lopez to let you know that I, Victor Anderson, am alive and well, somehow after what the heck happened at WrestleMania this past weekend and my broadcast in DeLand, Florida with Stetson getting swept by Eastern Kentucky. By the way, Eastern Kentucky plays North Florida next to last weekend of the A-Sun season. Could be for the regular season championship with the number one seed, Maddie Rutan. Keep your eye and eyes on her for the remainder of the season. As much as Eric is correct that I did have softball, I did have WrestleMania, I was not aware of the Country Music Awards, and I kind of don't listen to that much country music. Nonetheless, I digress. But one thing I do listen to and follow along with is the D1 Softball podcast. Jenna Becerra, Amanda Lorenz, talking about all the latest happenings in the sport of softball, and also taking your questions about the D1 Softball Top 25, which I am sure you will have plenty of questions about when it's released on Tuesday. They will talk about it on Wednesday on the D1 Softball podcast at high noon Eastern Standard Time, unless there are technical issues like there were this past week. And, of course, Jenna traveling across the world and getting herself more famous than Oprah Roddy for D1 Softball. So make sure you listen to the D1 Softball podcast with Jenna and Amanda Wednesdays at noon, wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. And speaking of podcast, your humble podcast in Inner Circle has a discount code if you want to get an annual subscription to D1 Softball. Things are starting to get hot and heavy as we get closer towards May and the mayhem that will ensue along with it. Use promo code CIRCLE25 to get 25% off your annual subscription to D1 Softball. What does that get you? It gets you access to the Daily Dozen. It gets you a look inside the head coaching and assistant coaching carousels, which will be hot and heavy, especially with the news of Mickey Dean get stepping away from Auburn at the end of the season. You also get access to the D1 transfer tracker and Eric Lopez's latest bracketology. And I'm sure he'll have some questions that I'm going to hopefully get him to answer when we resume and get back together on Thursday's episode. So, go to D1 Softball, get your annual subscription. Use promo code CIRCLE25 to get 25% off your annual subscription to D1 Softball. And as Mr. Tony likes to always say, use the code, people.
All right, let's turn over our attentions now over to Knoxville in the SEC, arguably one of the marquee series in the SEC this weekend. Certainly LSU Florida has right there. But all eyes within the SEC with Georgia, Tennessee, big SEC series. The Vols win the series 2 out of 3. And the person that was right there covering it for D1 Softball is our good friend, Ryan Podkey, back with us. Second appearance in as many weeks, which is a good thing. How you doing?
Good. I know this man, you two times. I don't know, like 2 out of 2. This is I'm honored, and I don't know, you know, what I've done to deserve this, but I appreciate you having me on. I guess it helps when you have a big series in your backyard, right? That always helps.
I mean, let's be real. When we circled this series, in a lot of ways, as a marquee SEC series of the year. Now, there's some big SEC series still ahead, as we'll talk about. But Tennessee wins the series 2 out of 3 without Kiki Malloy, which we'll get to because you broke that story prior to game 1 of this series. But what's your takeaway from Tennessee winning this series now against Georgia and Georgia now losing a second consecutive SEC series?
Yeah, it was definitely a much-needed big win for Tennessee, especially, like you said, without Malloy in the lineup. I think what it proved is that Tennessee has arguably, you know, one of the top two pitching tandems in the nation with Carlin Pickens and Peyton Gottschall. I mean, they were just lights out. You arguably could have had a sweep potentially if maybe they didn't – if they started Gottschall in game 2, you could possibly argue that because she came in, was lights out relieving, and only gave up one run that game. But just to really, I mean, to shut down that Georgia lineup like they did and then to have other players step in where Malloy normally is, it wasn't all smooth sailing without her though, but they filled all the roles that they needed to do. And I think it's a huge confidence boost to them to know that, like, hey, if we're, you know, if in the future something happens and we go through some adversity, we miss someone, we can still pull out wins, you know, and we have enough depth, we have enough big time players, and especially the pitching in the circle to get it done. And you know, it makes it even sweeter beating Georgia, which is a rival, and then staying at the top of the SEC standings, which is, you know, crucial. They, you know, as much as it, you can argue like SEC title, whatever, you know, it's everyone's playing for the top 8 seed because, you know, but the regular season title still does have value for a lot of these teams. So they definitely want to defend that title. And so it was really exciting win. I know Karen Weekly, head coach, when we talked to her after the game today, was very happy with how they performed all around. And just the grit, and she was, you know, much more competitive than she thought they were yesterday.
Obviously, you broke the story on Friday prior to game 1 of the series of Kiki Malloy being out with an injury. What can you share with us as far as her injury, what happened there, and what's her status moving forward?
Yeah, she rolled an ankle in practice, so it's not like, you know, I know lower body injury at first always sounds like, hopefully it's not like an ACL, so it's not super severe. It's severe enough to, you know, they didn't want to take the chance to have her out there, but she was in a boot this week in the dugout trying to, you know, hobble around as fast as she could to celebrate with the team. But she's expected to be back probably most likely this weekend. They think just a rolled ankle, just give it a few more days to heal, get some, you know, the rice treatment, rest ice, and stay off of it a little bit. But it's not, you know, they don't expect it to be long term. You never know with ankles, obviously. My ankles, once I turned them once, they were always turned for the rest of my life, particularly. But it's not a long-term thing, so she is expected to be back according to Weekly. She should be back in the lineup, you know, by this weekend, they believe. But you never know, but that's, you know, it sounds like it's pretty imminent she'll return.
Well, and they won without her, which is impressive, and a big series against a talented Georgia team. And you mentioned it. We spoke last week about Tennessee. The question with the depth of the pitching staff. Did they have enough? Now seeing them against a lineup like Georgia for the whole weekend, what's your takeaway? Does Tennessee have enough depth in the circle to make a run to OKC?
Well, they didn't showcase more depth than we went knowing last week that we talked about. But if those two can stay on the track they are and keep switching play, you know, trade off and keep their innings to a minimum in terms of trade offs, and they can get a few extra junk innings if they get big leads against some other teams in the future, they definitely do. Because if you have those two, I mean, you got two of the best in the country. But it's just a matter of if you can get, you know, just not wear them down too much. And it would be nice to have a legitimate third, like Charlie Orsini, they tried to throw in there to start game two. And it worked for a little bit, but they still haven't shown someone that against a lethal lineup like that can last, you know, super long. So I do think they have, I mean, if you have two, I still think you do have enough, but it would be better if they had a third that was at least could fill a little bit more innings. Whether they get that or not, I don't know, but they're going to ride with those two as far as they can. And I think they saw this week, and that's kind of what they're going to need to do to win series and to sweep series potentially.
I agree. That's why I kind of, I'm still kind of worried about that. Even though it wasn't too far long ago, Ryan, as you and I have covered softball for a long time, it used to be the two pitchers, that was deep enough.
Yes, it used to be way back in the day before, like every single pitch was analyzed and scouted, and you can get video and you can get like hot heat charts. And, you know, I was joking with someone this weekend. I think like our scouting was like you sit in the stands and like, okay, that was a ball, that was a strike. I think that was a curve. Like when we were doing it, that was our scouting. Now you have every single thing. You know, it's just hard to, you can scout pitchers so, you know, so well. But if you're as good as these pitchers are, like a Kelly Maxwell type, like a, you know, Carlin Pickens and Peyton, like, you know, your stuff against their stuff, I still think it's really hard to hit. So that's just the way it is. So again, you would love a third arm that could at least give you some serviceable innings, one or two. And they potentially still have that. Maybe Charlie works that way into it eventually. You don't know. But at this point right now, it's, you know, they got to go with those two and just hope that that works.
Georgia, is this a bump on the road? Are they fine? Or did you notice some concerns moving forward about Georgia?
It's hard to tell. I think head coach Tony Ball, definitely frustrated. You know, offensively, it's hard to judge against these, you know, like these pitchers are good. I think he would have liked to see a little bit more. I mean, their pitching was great this weekend. That's not what lost the game. I mean, Shelby Walters was, you know, tremendous, made, you know, a few, you don't want to call them mistakes. I mean, they hit a good pitch. Sophia Nugent hit a hard pitch out of the park. That was not an easy pitch to take out of the park. So pitching wise, I think he was very impressed. I think he thought Walters pitched her best game of the season, you know, relief wise on Saturday, just looking really back. So I think I think offensively teams can go in a little bit of right here or there. Again, the pitching they're facing, you have to consider that. I think this lineup has enough weapons that one or two are going to start to, you know, get hold. And their freshman Digby came through this weekend, even though she was like one of the only ones to really hit. And Sarah Gordon got a nice homer. She'd been struggling. So in spite of the rest of the lineup kind of going, you know, not really having success, they did have some people that weren't having success have success. So if they can just get that other parts going again, which they have the ability to do, they have talented hitters in that lineup. But they're not happy about this stretch. I mean, you lose two SEC series. That's not great. And that's something that you can quickly fall down the standings in the SEC. So I think they just need to, you know, their offense hasn't been quite as potent as I think they want it to be and was, you know, dubbed to be. So I think that's where but that's where they specialize, right? So I think they have the ability with all the, you know, the coaches they have there and the talent on the roster to turn that around. It's just going to take someone to kind of get that spark going again.
I mean, that's the funny thing is they're up 1-0, right, in the sixth inning on Sunday, that close to the finish line of winning a series on the road against Tennessee, and yet we're like, what's wrong? But I think it's because we have such high expectations for their offense. I mean, they've said it themselves. They feel this is the best roster they've had there, which is saying something. And we know those players are as good as it gets. And I think sometimes we kind of were surprised when they get shut down to a point. Tennessee has two electric arms. But this is two weekends in a row that they've kind of been shut down a little bit, especially in that last game of the series. Arkansas, I think, held them to two runs on Monday night. They have more questions on the pitching side at Arkansas. So I think that's why people question there with Georgia. You and I talked last week. We thought on paper, maybe these are the two best teams in the SEC. Having seen them in person, do you still feel that way? Or, you know, LSU Florida, as we're recording, has split the first two in Gainesville. They've had two dramatic games. There, LSU winning in extra innings on Sunday, Florida coming from behind on Saturday. Arkansas coming off the win at Georgia wins a series against Missouri. If you had your little personal power poll in the SEC, how would you rank it?
Yeah, it's really hard right now, honestly, like you said. I mean, I think it would be right now to me between LSU and Georgia for that second spot and then Arkansas and Nick behind. It's just like, but I, you know, and Georgia's got to prove it. They got to hit. I mean, you can't just like, I think if you go roster, you know, the roster, you'd say that clearly, but, so yeah, that would be, I mean, it, I right now I'd probably just give it to, we'll see the result of the Florida series, but LSU and, but they're right there. Those two to me, I couldn't definitively tell you. I think if Georgia's hitting all cylinders, they're still to me the second best, but it's the proofs in the wins, right? You got to win the games. Like you can have all the talent in the world. And if you're not going to win and you're falling down, I can't say that about you. So, you know, before that series over, I guess right now I'd put LSU in that two spot and maybe I'd still pick Georgia three, maybe Arkansas, you know, even though they just beat them, which that's stupid to say. So I don't know, maybe Arkansas above them, but right. Like all those three, I think you could on any weekend, you could like right now flip a coin. But I do think Tennessee is because of their pitching and because of their, you know, this depth of their lineup has, you know, still remains at the top for me.
Can Florida enter that conversation if they were to win the Monday night game and win the series against LSU? They won a series at Alabama. They've won a series at Mississippi State. I don't think we expect them to be at near the top because of the youth in the circle with Rothrock and company. But, boy, they can hit. Could they enter the conversation if they win this Monday night game against LSU in the series?
They definitely can. I mean, this like that. That's a team, too, where even you have to kind of, you know, with as much youth as they have and new parts coming, some of those – I don't want to call them inexplicable, but you know, losses they suffered early in the season, like my, with Florida, mine was always going to be, how did they look like halfway through? Because you knew it was going to be a maturation, you know, process for that team. So it's just, can those freshmen, and they have shown that they're definitely able to handle the, you know, the SEC and the grind. Obviously they're freshmen. They could still hit a wall, as we talked about a little bit last week. It's possible, but my always thing was, it's Florida's arrow's pointing straight up, and like that curve's going to be up, and so they could work their way up to the top because it's mainly just, you know, getting the new pieces to work together and getting some of that youth to get used to the SEC. So yeah, I judge Florida more on what, you know, from SEC going forward than some of the preseasons or, you know, non-conference stuff, because that was just kind of like, hey, let's, you know, dip our toes. They didn't play the strongest of schedules, you know, to start out. But I really do think that they're, you know, that after, if they do take LSU series there, they're definitely one that you have to watch out for, because that's just going to give them more confidence.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. They played a soft, by their standards, a soft non-conference, partly because of the youth in the pitching. That's why their RPI is not as high as, say, the polls suggest how good they might be. But they've got games still to go with Georgia series coming up. They got a couple with Florida State midweeks, etc. And LSU scout got Tennessee on the schedule later. Is that in your backyard too? LSU Tennessee. I'm trying to remember in Knoxville. That could be a showdown there that could decide the SEC race when they play later on this season. From that standpoint, I want to ask you a couple more things. Obviously, the big story this weekend in the sport: Texas wins the series against Oklahoma. Rightfully so. We both said last week Oklahoma gets the benefit of the doubt. Class above. Texas proved a lot of people. They won the series, winning 2-1 Saturday night. Dramatic finish, the throw at home plate with the relay with Texas, and then they win it again Sunday, 2-1. What's your reaction to Texas winning this series against Oklahoma?
Well, I think it's huge in terms of, I think the biggest thing that I noticed for Texas was defense and pitching were solid, which defense has not always been something that's been solid for Texas. And you could argue that's one of that won them some of those the games, especially that play at the plate. That's got to be a really, really encouraging sign for Texas, because that's kind of been a bugaboo for them in big spots in the past. So if they, and it takes a clean game to beat OU, and Texas is not intimidated by OU. We've seen that over the years. I think a lot of the Big 12 teams, like, there's really no intimidation factor. I mean, they not always beat them, but like between Oklahoma State and Texas, they're not afraid of OU. So it's got to be a very confidence boosting victory to get that, you know, and to be honest, like this OU team's looked, and I hate, you know, vulnerable for a team that's so good as they are, but compared to past seasons, they've been more vulnerable this year. Like, they're more beatable. They're not, their offense isn't, it has a lot of weapons, but it's shown at times that it's not quite as explosive in certain times than it's been in the past. So I think Texas, you know, just that's got to be a huge shot in the arm for them. And especially the way it was done, holding that offense down and playing clean defense. I think that's two things that Mike White's going to be really, really happy about, because that's what you need to do if you're going to win a national title when he gets down to that crunch time, and they show they can do it.
Now, about April 19th in Knoxville, LSU
yes,
and Tennessee.
I was just going to tell you that. Woo! Yeah.
To your backyard.
I know. And it's, let's see, it's a 6 noon and 2, which I like the noon and 2s. Like, I'm all about the, so ESPN 2 are the two, like, weekend games, and SEC Network, the Friday 6 p.m. game. So I will be out there for that. Then, you
know, oh, all right. So it sounds like I'm going to have to give you next week weekend off, then bring you back on the show after that series. That's a big series in the SEC on that. Couple of last things before I let you go. Obviously, the big story in sports this week, Sunday, the women's national championship game. South Carolina wins it, beats Caitlin Clark in Iowa. A massive, successful women's basketball tournament. The semifinal between Iowa and UConn drew about 14 million, making it the second most watched non-football sports telecast in ESPN history, behind a World Cup game between the U.S. and Portugal back in a few World Cups ago. You and I were talking off there. This South Carolina-Iowa game is expected to be a monster whopper of a rating. I think it'll outdraw the men's title game, personally. And I think this will be maybe 15, 20 million. Maybe the most, right? We're thinking in our heads here?
I said at least 18 a few days ago. That was my prediction. Now, whether I'm right, I don't know. But I'm expecting at least 18 million on ABC, you know, and everyone, being that those other two games were on cable. And the men, obviously, kind of, you know, there's a little bit of, like, we have to give the qualifier. It's on TBS this year too, so that's going to cut down on some of the viewing. It's not on CBS.
Sure. But even with that, the women's tournament has had more interesting storylines than the men's. I mean, to this point.
I just want to, like, I don't like the comparisons. I'm sick of that. Like, I think they're both awesome. It's not you. The men's is awesome. The women's is awesome. We don't need to compare them. They can be covered differently. They can be viewed differently. The numbers can be different. The times can be different. I get so sick of the comparisons. It's like, let each one be as great for what it is. So both of them.
For sure.
It's not you, Eric. I'm just saying, like,
Right. But it's huge. I mean, like, I'm not a big women's basketball fan, but even though I've been in, watch the semifinal game. Like, that's what I'm saying. It's grabbing casual. Like,
yes.
I consider myself more of a casual women's hoops person, not a fan. It's been huge.
Been instrumental, and obviously Caitlin Clark's led the charge. But man, the talent across the board, and there's some freshmen this year that are going to keep people locked, like Juju Watkins and Hannah Hidalgo and Malaysia Fawiley, who we saw tonight, and Madison Booker.
Sure.
This is a turning point. We're finally at the place where a lot of us 20 years ago were yelling that we should have been 20 years ago, but finally it's brought like the cultural crescendo, the culture. And I think softball, we saw a little bit of the same with the World Series. It's a great time for women's sports and basketball. It's finally getting the due it's deserved. And we're in the middle of basically a seminal moment for sports, I believe, in women's sports. And it's tremendous. And that this game tonight, I watched it. It lived up to the hype. It was great. Dawn Staley, it's amazing. They replace all five starters and they go 38-0 and win a national title. That's tremendous. Second in 2 years for the South Carolina.
So, and I agree. Does softball have, do you have an idea if softball has their version of a Caitlin Clark that you see right now playing, or maybe we don't have that yet, but could be coming years from now for softball to take another step in the viewership, kind of like women's basketball is taking another step for that level with her and Paige Beckers and everything. Does softball have that player type that can grab a casual audience, you think, either this year or in the near future?
I don't think this year per se. Maybe in the near future, you'd have to have we're trending to be like the opposite, but you know, like a Kat Osterman or a
Jess
type. You need, you know, another one of those dominant pitchers. Or I mean, you like, honestly, there's a few that could qualify, like Kiki Malloy, Jada Coleman, those types. Chiara Jennings. I mean, they should be those types. I mean, Jocelyn Otto, because
Otto was, yeah,
because she was a home run hitter. So we're fascinated with the home runs and the pitching. I mean, they have the types of athletes that could break through like that. It's just hard to break through. And, like, you have to do something like Clark with the logo threes and be, like, generational. And it's a tough thing. So if we get another pitcher like that, certainly it could be happen. I mean, certainly. I think, you know, we almost saw it like Jordy Ball type.
Yes.
If she was to get healthy again and go on a roll, that could be something, like, you know, obviously we didn't see it this season because of the ACL injury. But say her next two seasons she comes back, she's lights out, she's doing that. That potentially could be someone, but someone like her in the future, too. I mean, it's almost similar to Caitlin Clark, staying home, playing for the hometown school. Granted, Jordy Ball went, you know, to Oklahoma first, but now she's back in Nebraska, hometown school, lifting up that program. So if the next 2 years she does something similar, you could see, you know, more eyes. I'm not going to equate her to Caitlin Clark, but you could see maybe an increase in, like, the, you know, the fan that's not always completely tuned into softball, but like
right. No, that's my point. Yeah, like that's my point. Like, I think Otto did that. Otto, there was a presence there when she was at the plate that even people stopped. Like, SportsCenter did features on her on everything. I think you're right. The pitcher is always the attraction there. And with more staff committee approaches, I do worry if we're headed kind of the direction like Major League Baseball, where the star pitchers are not as many as there used to be from a star attraction standpoint. We'll see. Time will tell. But I think that's the interesting thing now with women's basketball and what their success is having, if softball can get to that point. Because even volleyball is starting to grow, too. Let's not forget them and the success they've had in the fall.
Oh, no.
Recently,
no,
last couple of years as well. Yeah. So we'll see. But we got a great product as it is. And, of course, you're awesome, and you cover all of this stuff, which is why I always ask you about this, because you have a great perspective, because you cover women's basketball on the side. I admit it, you have a lot of hats. And you somehow take the time to talk to us here on the show, which we appreciate a little bit. But you've got a recap coming up, right? D1 softball. Tell us what you got coming up this on the site here.
Yeah, well, the two game stories from Tennessee, Georgia are up there right now. They can find those at D1 softball. We'll have What We Learned This Weekend that'll post tomorrow or late tonight, tomorrow morning, about Graham Hayes, Justin McCloy, me, our thoughts on kind of what we observed this weekend. We always try to kind of spread it around, not do some of the obvious. We kind of some of the offbeat stuff, too, in that What We Learned, because there's other things taking place in the country besides those two big series. You've got Justin's two gamers that are going to be up there, too, on the site. And then we'll have the rankings come out Tuesdays because we wait for the Monday game, because that obviously usually is a big factor. SECs, you know, when you have that many good teams, you know it's going to factor in. So Tuesday rankings. And then right back on the grind, the typical weekends, the weekly stuff. So we got tons of stuff up there right now. And so, you know, I'd encourage everyone to get there and subscribe if you haven't. And if you haven't, what are you doing? So it's totally worth it. And I'm not just being biased. It's if I wasn't a writer, I would totally subscribe, because it's worth it if you're a softball fan.
Yeah, how do you think I feel? I got to do bracketology stuff, too. Like, I have to wait to that Monday night game. I got to wait. It's not
all the SIDs looking to make sure they're a top 8 seed so they can host. They're all
My phone blows up every time it comes out. It's kind of nuts on that. But all right, Randy, I know you got a lot more writing stuff, other things you got to do as well, because you're like me. You got a lot of hats to cover. But hey, thanks for joining us, covering the series from Knoxville there. Great series, Georgia, Tennessee. We'll have you back on, I'm sure, probably for maybe LSU, Tennessee there. But in the meantime, thanks for always talking to us here on In the Circle on D1 Softball.
Anytime. I'm always a joy to come on, and I appreciate you you letting me know and having me on, because it's I can never talk enough about softball and women's sports overall. So anytime you need me, I will be a call away.
And thanks again to Rhianna Pocky for joining Eric from Knoxville after that wild series. And of course, you hear her conversation about Kiki Malloy, who was not available for Tennessee this weekend, but the Lady Vols were able to overcome, take the series versus the Bulldogs, and I think put themselves in position to sneak in as a top four national seed. They got a big series coming up in 2 weeks versus LSU, and the winner of that series will have a big stake in saying that we are worthy of a top four national seed. But you'll get to read about that in Eric's latest bracketology coming up on D1Softball.com. Someone who knows a thing or two about playing in high leverage situations for Team Canada will be joining us right now. Of course, we're talking about Joey Lai. Coach Lai was part of Athletes Unlimited, of course, was a former college head coach, a reference member of Team Canada. What is she up to now, and how is she still contributing and making the sport of softball a much better game than when she entered it? You'll hear about that and much more as Eric Lopez catches up with Joey Lai right here and In a Circle on D1 Softball.
Joining us now is a longtime friend of the podcast who I got to run into in Clearwater at the Trolley. It was pretty fun weekend there at the Clearwater Invitational back in February before Mother Nature interrupted things. Of course, she is an Olympian. A medalist, won the bronze for the Team Canada in the recent Olympics, was part of the great Canadian national team for almost over a decade as a player, now part of the coaching pool, longtime college coach, and still involved in the sport today. I speak of our good friend Joey Lai joining us here on In the Circle on D1 Softball. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Eric. Thank you so much for having me again. Always a pleasure to be here.
I was impressed. You've recognized me right away at the Trolley. Like, I was like, oh shoot, there you. Like, I was that meant a lot to me that you remembered me. So it's good. You've been busy, so we haven't had you on in a while. So I did enjoy that, catching up with you.
Awesome. Yes, it was great. I mean, I had my eyes out looking for who were some people I recognized, was just spending my day solo there. So it was yeah, it was fun to see you getting on the trolley heading over there to see some great softball.
That was fun. That was fun catching up there. Let's tell the audience what you've been up to now. Tell us what you've been up to now and what you're working on.
After the Olympics, I was in a place, let me tell you, trying to figure out what is next. And as you mentioned, I had been a longtime college coach, and I decided to go in a little bit of a different direction. I created my own company, speaking and consulting, and I've been fortunate to travel the country speaking to teams and schools, athletic departments. I had an amazing time doing a Title IX keynote in celebration of 50 years of Title IX. That was at St. Olaf in Minnesota, and have just reconnected with so many former colleagues and friends who are still coaching around the country and being able to impact their programs and their schools. And I've done some clinics. I recently moved to Florida and have connected with the little leagues in the area. Done some softball clinics with them, thanks to Michelle Smith hooking me up, and have dove into the corporate space as well. I have a 10-week mastermind for a C-suite executives coming up shortly to just dive into helping them kind of grow their bottom line by getting more buy-in from their staff and more retention and stronger culture within their department and business as a whole, pulling everything that I've learned from my Olympic experience and Olympic journey, and just trying to empower as many people as I can.
What led you to go into that direction? What was it? Because you mentioned you were kind of trying to figure out what you wanted to do after the Olympics. I'm sure you thought about, do I want to go back to coaching? Do I want to now go back to coaching? But what was it that this drew you in? And obviously, it's built it and to the point where I see you now, like talking to a lot of people all over the place.
There was a lot of self-reflection after getting back from Tokyo and really digging deep into why did I coach college for so long? Why did I enjoy it? And what I discovered was the thing I loved most about it was the impact on the people. Yes, I love softball. Yes, I love coaching. But what I loved the most about it was seeing these individuals grow and become super successful, not just in their sport, but in life. And so I thought to myself, how can I do this on a bigger scale? And that with the added bonus of I can now control my own schedule, which is really, really nice.
Very nice. And you speak to a lot of schools and everything. Where can people find out more about what you're up to? And because I have a hard time keeping track with you. I can only imagine. But I know you've built this big because I've seen a lot of schools talk about thanking you for talking to them and being inspiration because you have a lot of great experiences. Where can they find out more info?
Instagram's a great place. LinkedIn's a great place. And then my website is joey-lie.com. And services are listed there. All of the events I've done are listed there. And there's buttons to contact me, which I love and appreciate getting those inquiries.
What's the ultimate goal you want to have to set for everybody? You mentioned the growth of them, grow as people, but what's the message you sent out to people?
My three biggest points or pillars are mindset, leadership, and team culture. And those three things had such an impact on me as an athlete and as a coach and as our program. I mean, we won the first medal in Softball Canada history at the Olympics, and it was because of those things, our individual mindsets, our collective mindset, the culture we built as a program, and the leadership that we had within that group. And all three of those things start with understanding ourselves, understanding what we need in times of stress and how we receive communication, how we can productively communicate with others. And it's so eye-opening to me how important understanding of self is and how often it is glossed over or completely ignored. And so that is one thing that I love diving into with individuals is just getting at a deeper understanding of self, and it allows us to gain a whole new perspective of the world. I also recently became certified in mental performance mastery, and the mindset piece of playing was just, it's what allowed me to sustain such a long career and also to be able to perform when my name was called. Towards the end of my career, I was a role player, and you never know when you're going to get called off the bench or an opportunity to start a game. And the ability to perform for me came from mastering my mind. And so I'm really, really excited to help people do that. And again, understanding of self is the one underlying thing that I challenge everyone to just think about a little bit more.
Interesting that you bring up the mental side of the game, because as we know, softball is mostly a game of failure, and it messes with your mind. What got you interested in going deep into that and kind of exploring that to the point now where you're trying to master that and help other players deal with that everybody's going to deal with in, when you play in a sport like softball?
I think majoring in psychology in college was one thing that got me interested in the brain to begin with. And just through my own struggle, through my own challenges with confidence, it just really intrigued me that we could learn to be more confident. We could work our brain like our other muscles and get stronger and stronger in that area and be able to perform under any circumstance and essentially control our own fate. I think so many athletes go through a practice or a game or a season relying on so many external factors, and the power lies in ourselves and our ability to have our own brain on our own side. And so knowing and understanding how much that impacted me as an athlete, and seeing many of my teammates working through that process and having ups and downs, and still now as a coach with Team Canada, being able to help those younger athletes work through that same process and see how much it impacts them on the field and off the field. It's unbelievable when you master your mind on the field, what that actually plays out to look like in your daily life. And I just want to share that with more people.
What's a couple of things you've learned about it that you wish you knew, say, 5, 10 years ago?
Ooh, I think it took me a really long time to block out other people's opinions of me. And so I think finally grasping the idea and the concept that my opinion of myself is the one that matters. Of course, you hear that a lot, but it's one thing to hear it, and it's a whole nother thing to actually live that and feel that. And if only I could have harnessed that earlier in life, who knows what would have happened or where I would be right now. But the fact that I can say I got to that space and I was able to step on the field and know myself and hear my own voice and have my routines that were set in stone to help me perform, that's what I think. You know, if you can bottle that up and have that for your whole career, my goodness.
Are you talking about like opinions of the coaches, fans, media? What when you say block it out, what parts would you feel like block it out? Because nowadays the players today, they've got to deal with social media, so they're on social media all the time, and if things don't go well, they're going to hear about it, so they got to block that out. You didn't have to deal with that as much when you played until the back end, but talk about some what things you have to block out.
Yes, I think all of the above. Yes. The coaches, and often we are projecting what we think the coaches are thinking about us in that moment based on body language and facial expression and not necessarily word. And we kind of fill in the blanks of those stories and create these narratives for ourselves and our teammates as well. You know, we all want to be our best athlete. We all want to do right by our team. And when we fail, we can also, in those moments, think we're letting our teammates down or create narratives for what they're now thinking of us. And we're so much harder on ourselves that we amplify that when most of the other athletes and coaches are thinking about other things and they understand failure is part of the game and trust that you're going to get the next one. And I think that the social media piece that you bring up is just, it is mind-blowing how many comments these athletes are getting thrown at them these days on social media. And it's almost as though the internet takes out the reality that there's a human being on the other end of the comments these people are making. And for those athletes who are in the game today and battling those, to know that there are 10 times as many people, maybe even 100 times as many people who are in their corner. And it, unfortunately, there are a few voices that are so loud. And yes, blocking those out can be super challenging. But the more we can gain control of our own mind and trust our own voice and surround ourselves with a strong support system, we're going to set ourselves up for success.
How do you prevent being your own worst enemy, though? Because I've seen it where players will put too much pressure on themselves as a result, and that affects their performance. They're trying to hit a grand slam when there's nobody on base, right? Like, you know what I'm talking about. So what have you learned about dealing with that? Because sometimes from a mental standpoint, you're your worst enemy.
Absolutely. We are our worst enemy more often than not. And for me, I found the magic was to be in the moment. And how could I set myself up to be in the moment even when the game was on the line, or even when my name was called to start a game for the first time in a while? And it's natural to put that pressure to perform. And for me, a lot of it came from doing some breath work away from the field, practicing working through anxiety when I was in situations in life that gave me anxiety, and using those moments to think about preparing myself for softball, and self-talk, getting in control of my self-talk and really being intentional about that on a daily basis, not just when things weren't going well in the softball field, but setting a reminder in my phone that went off every day with a positive message, and leaving myself sticky notes in the cupboard or on my mirror, and just constantly feeding myself with those phrases or that mindset that I wanted to embody. And the last point I would bring up around that is challenging myself, putting myself in situations where I'm going to get outside my comfort zone. And so therefore, the negative thoughts are going to come about, and practice dealing with that. I cannot say enough how important it was for my journey to get outside my comfort zone, to challenge myself, and to really intentionally face those battles and see how I dealt with them and really work to harness my mindset and my intentional dialogue that I had while going through those challenges.
I think another thing too, from a mental standpoint, is a player who maybe has a role on the team that they're not what they envision, and they hear about it from family members who mean well, but you know, maybe are a little biased in their opinions on certain things and what the coaches are doing and everything like that. How do you deal with that from a mental standpoint to make sure you're a good teammate and not harming the team, even though maybe you're not maybe satisfied with, quote, the role that you've been given?
That is one of the biggest challenges, I think. Society values playing time. Society values that on-field success. And our families, our parents and guardians, the first question is, are you going to play, or did you play? And then the next answer is, how did you do? And we get so far away from, did you enjoy yourself? Did you pour into your team? Did your team get after it today as a unit? Was everybody bought in? And getting young athletes to understand that when there's so much noise on social media and in society and with families asking questions like that is a huge challenge. And we battle it every day as coaches. You know, last spring I was back coaching at my alma mater, and it was there in full force, right? Everybody wants to be on the field. Everybody wants to be playing, and playing time, it seems to be the topic of conversation and the currency everybody wants. And in reality, the currency is not playing time. It is, are we bought in to our team, and are we productively pushing towards that goal? And my signature talk when I'm working with teams is, does my medal mean less? And I pass my medal around the room, and as I'm starting my talk, I say to them, I have a feeling not a single person in this room was holding that medal in their hands and thinking, do you think she started? Because at the end of the day, when every athlete is bought into their role, even if they're not satisfied in it, I wanted to play every game. When every athlete is bought into the role that they have on a given day, it is insane what a team can accomplish and get after. And every one of us that was a part of that journey is just as proud of what our team did as the next person.
That's really good. You're right. It's a great point. We're speaking with Joey Lai here on In the Circle on D1 Softball. Let's talk about that bronze medal you earned there with Team Canada and that journey. Because I remember when we had you on, you were with Bucknell. And at the time, you were trying to balance both out, trying to train, but also coach. You eventually made the decision to back away from coaching and just focus specifically on training. Take me through that journey just to get to the Olympics. Because that was a unique journey with a lot of hurdles, not just from trying to make the team performance, but then you've got a pandemic, you're wondering what's going to happen with the Olympics, and then a unique Olympics as it is. So just take us through that journey for those that may not be aware, because you had to deal with a lot of tough decisions and hurdles during that time period.
Absolutely. Talk about facing challenges. My goodness. And I'll bring in social media to this piece as well, because throughout that time, like, yes, it was super challenging to choose to step away from my job, my career, and become an athlete with no, solid source of income. Yes, it was challenging when the pandemic hit and we all got sent home and nobody knew what was going to happen. And yes, it was challenging when the Canadian Olympic Committee decided we would not be sending athletes if the games were to continue in 2020. That 48 hours before the Olympic Committee announced that there was a delay, going to be a year delay. But I think the biggest challenge along the way was waking up every morning during that Olympic delay, wondering if the Olympics were going to happen. And still attacking the daily preparation. Social media was terrible during that time. Every news source was sending out articles and ideas that the Olympics were going to be canceled. And there were former Canadian athletes who were in support of the Olympics being canceled. And it was a lot to carry. And at one point, I finally stopped looking at all news, period, cut myself off and said to all my family and friends, because everybody, kept sending me the articles. Did you see this? Did you see this? And so I finally just said to all my family and friends, please, no more news. I'm going to live in my little bubble where I am thinking the Olympics are going to happen, and I'm going to wake up every day training like they are. And I just cannot deal with this negativity, this narrative that they're not going to happen every single day. And so thankfully, my family and friends supported that. And so I created that little bubble, and there still was, the doubt in the back of my mind that I had to battle, but at least it was not getting fed with new, fresh news every single day. But that was by far the biggest challenge for me. Through the whole process was waking up every single day, giving my all, training like they were going to happen with that little seed of doubt that they were going to be canceled.
And they got delayed by a year, so that works out. Take me through that now, knowing, hey, we're going to Tokyo to participate in the Olympics, limited attendance. It's not the Olympics you're used to, but yet it's still the Olympics. So what was that experience like?
My goodness, what a unique experience. I first have to comment on that extra year of training. I just talked about the challenges within it. It was also the greatest gift that I could have ever imagined in my athletic career. I would never wish a pandemic on the world. I would always wish for that extra year of training where I did get to just be an athlete and I got to dive into a season of Athletes Unlimited softball, and I got to train with OGX softball and get to know myself on a deeper level as an athlete, understand my biomechanics, how my body was moving, how to maximize myself. And I improved more in that year than any year prior in my professional career. And it was such an amazing, incredible way to end my softball career. And despite there being no fans, yes, that was disappointing. Stepping up onto the podium, receiving our medals, and doing the wave to the fans. and there's literally no one there, but hopefully it was a good show for those watching on TV. And the coolest thing about it was that our team was so close. We loved each other so much. Fans could see that and feel that through the TV. And so I think for our personal experience, it almost didn't matter that there weren't fans. Maybe it was even a competitive advantage for us because we only needed each other. And it allowed us to leverage our connection and perform at the top of our game and be our best selves and know that our family and support system were watching back at home and still feel that support. But really just focus on ourselves and focus on the game. And it was really an incredible experience. I'm getting goosebumps right now talking about it, thinking about it, and stepping onto that podium for the first time in Canadian history and putting our medals on each other. That was another thing that we did because of COVID. The officials were not allowed to medal us. We were to pick up our own medal. And so we as a team decided we were going to hand it to the teammate standing next to us and they were going to medal us and have that special moment. And I just got another round of goosebumps thinking about that. It was the most incredible moment of my career.
Wow, I forgot about that part. I remember watching the game, but put the medal on you, and who did you put the medal on them? Who got the honors there?
Well, fun story about that as well. A few days before that, my dear teammate, now player, Erica Polidori, came up to me in our apartment and she almost had a tear in her eye. And she said, "Joey, I cannot wait to medal you, to put your medal around your neck. It will just be such an honor." And then it turned out the way it worked out that I actually got to medal her. And the individual who medaled me was the one and only Jennifer Salling.
Wow. Just that, is it just worked out that way? It was just kind of random.
Yeah, because we were just in number order, so
Oh,
yeah.
wow. I did not know that. That's pretty wild. Take me through that game against Mexico, though, because I could not only imagine the pressure they're in. That was a very tightly contested Olympics, very close games. I mean, literally, you're a couple swings away from playing for the gold medal, right? Like, it was that tight. But here you are playing Mexico, bronze medal, and this is it. You got to win this game to get that historic first medal. I know that wasn't the ultimate goal. Your goal was to win the gold, but you definitely wanted a medal coming out of Tokyo for the first time for the Canadians. So take me through that game, because that's probably as about as pressure as it gets right there, knowing that it's medal or bust here.
Absolutely, yes. And like you said, our sights were set on the gold. Our hashtag was gold medal mission. That's what we were working towards for the entire Olympic cycle leading up to the games. And the 1-0 loss to the US and then the 1-0 loss in extra innings to Japan meant we were in that bronze game. And that was the toughest challenge I've ever had to overcome as a team. Was when we lost that game in extra innings to Japan, and the reality sank in that we would not be able to play for the gold medal. And we had a huge moment. We rode back to the Athletes Village in silence. We got off the bus, and I can't remember who it was, but someone said, "Hey, everyone stay here before we go back to our rooms." And we all, put our arms around each other, stood in a circle, and talked about how terrible we were feeling and how awful this moment was, and that we had been working so hard for one thing, and now that thing was out of reach. And we decided as a group that we were going to sit in that suck until the end of dinner. And once dinner was over, once we left the dining hall, it was time to focus on tomorrow because the tournament was not over and we still had history to make for our country and we still had an opportunity in front of us. And we bought into that and we sat in the grossness through dinner and allowed ourselves to feel it because we knew if we didn't, we would carry that forward. And so moving forward from that, we readjusted and worked through that individually and as a group, and stepped into the next day still ready to compete and to keep pushing forward and to make history for our country. And when it came down to that bronze medal game against Mexico, my goodness, that might have been the most anxiety I felt throughout the whole tournament, throughout most of my career. Being on the bench, I was in the pinch runner role, right? So now we're getting down to the wire. It's 3-2, and I have no control. I can't impact the game physically, right? Just on the bench. And so I was cheering my head off. I was giving as much energy as I could into our program, and just I knew in my gut that we were going to do it. And I think our whole team did too. And that might have been the difference in the game. Our whole team as a unit had that deep down belief that we were going to do it, that game was not going to end unless we were on top. And feeling that was pretty incredible too. And that moment of that final, the tension, you can feel the tension in the stadium, and then that final pitch is thrown and the game's over, and it's almost disbelief with relief, with excitement, with oh my goodness, I don't even know how to describe this feeling. And just so proud of my teammates and my team and what we were able to do together.
I remember that because that was a quick turnaround too, right? After that extra inning game with Japan, it was not like you had a couple days to recover. You literally had to get back on it. Like I remember watching that like around midnight, but you found a way to win and get that medal, bronze medal. And for people that don't know, this is not like pro sports where we'll get them next year. There is no next year in the Olympics, right? Like, did you know this was going to be the last time you would play? Did you know in your mind, back of your mind, you were going to retire after this Olympics?
Yes, I did.
Wow.
And yeah, so that added weight of,
Right. That's my point. You're
yeah.
adding more pressure to yourself by saying, I'm going to retire after this tournament. You're not going to let it play out. You're like, you've already decided. So that's also part of your mental kind of challenges there.
Absolutely. And I believe there were seven of us who were in that boat. We were all retiring after Tokyo, and this was it. And we were here to do this and to, for some, it was their second or third Olympic Games, and to finally, do the damn thing and get a medal for the first time. And for those of us who it was our first time, we had been playing, for myself, that was year 12 with the national team, and the first time we were in the Olympics and able to have that opportunity. And so, yes, there were definitely added layers of pressure there. And another reason why it was so important to master our mindset and be able to be in the moment, knowing all that was at stake.
That's remarkable. Of course, we now know the Olympic softball will be back in Los Angeles 2028. What was your reaction when you heard that? And what do you think is gonna to transpire here in the last 4 years? Because I talked to Jen Salling, who your friend there, who's obviously assistant at UCF, talking about the funding aspect, how this is huge for Canada and funding across the world. What's your reaction to the Olympics back here in 28 LA?
That announcement was extremely exciting for the younger athletes within our program, for the sport as a whole. And I think that if we can gain some momentum here in the next 4 years, and maybe, just maybe, Australia will also announce it for 2032, and we can have 8 years of excitement around softball on an international stage, and maybe be able to enter the program officially. That would be the dream. And I think all of those thoughts were flooding through when that announcement was made for 2028. But the biggest thing for me was the pride that I felt competing for Canada as an athlete, and the potential possibility to be involved with that on the coaching side. But more so, the opportunity for those younger athletes who maybe just missed it in Tokyo. And now that dream is back alive for them, and for even younger athletes who weren't even close. Maybe they were too young or they weren't in the system yet. And now that dream is alive again. And we will hopefully get more funding poured into the program and programs across the world, and to help softball grow in competitiveness and just be the exciting game that it deserves to be.
Yeah, I mean, in talking to many people, Europe is a big key in that as well, to kind of talk them into softball as well. And it's going to be really fascinating. Now, you mentioned you're part of the coaching pool for the Canadian national team. Is that something you want to be a part of that staff? Is that the only place you would come back to coach full time? You mentioned you coached at your alma mater last year. Is coaching only at Team Canada, or are you still leaving the door slightly open for perhaps coaching down the road?
Team Canada is where my heart lies right now with regard to coaching, and I've really enjoyed being able to drop into programs across the country and connect with leaders and work with those captains, work with those coaches, and develop as many programs as I can or support them in their development. And so for me, I don't see myself jumping back into another coaching role. I think going back to my alma mater last spring was my coach who's still there. She gave me a call and said, my assistant just got a head job. It's during the school year. It's a tough time to hire. Do you think this could work? I'm getting creative. And so we ended up working out a deal. It was a 6-month contract. And what a cool opportunity to be able to drop into the program where, I played college and my coaching career started and be able to come full circle to that and get another taste for what the post-pandemic collegiate athlete is like. And that was really eye-opening for me and super helpful in the line of work I'm in right now to be able to have that understanding and have lived it on the daily through a season.
What's the most common question you get asked when you speak, do the speaking engagements and everything? What's the most common question you get asked?
I would have to say it is, how do you stay so motivated? And that question is so interesting to me because it's not about motivation at the end of the day. Motivation comes and goes. There were days that I woke up super excited to go to practice, super excited to tackle things. That was not every day. That was far from every day. And I think I mentioned earlier, sticky notes on my mirror or in my cupboard and reminders on my phone. And really, the magic sauce is being disciplined and making the daily decision to be invested versus always feeling excited about it. It's exhausting to have your emotions always running on high and working to have that level of motivation every single day. And not that the decision to be invested every day is easy, but it's a decision that we can make every day. We have the power to make that decision every single day. So, yeah, that's for sure the most common question I get.
As being someone that's played now in the Olympics, and I know it's a different Olympics, but what advice would you give for the people on the Canadian national team here in 2028 that you think is important, whether it be on the field or even off the field from the Olympic experience? What, based on your experience, what advice would you give them?
I think push yourself to understand what you need in order to perform at your best. And that's in the realm of mindset and working on our mental game. But I just think not just for softball, also for the rest of your life, when you unlock more information about yourself and really when you're challenged, when you get down, when you get kicked, when you're already down, how can you get up stronger than you were before? If you can figure that out for yourself, because we're all different, we all need different things. We all need different things internally and externally. And when we can figure that out and then communicate that with our support system, it's really incredible what you can get out of yourself.
Mention your involvement with Athletes Unlimited, how key of a factor that is. I spoke to Georgina Court. She says she's going to play Athletes Unlimited to extend her career because she wants to be obviously with Great Britain in the Olympics. I would imagine that's going to be a key factor, not just for American players, but players internationally. Playing in Japan might come over and play Athletes Unlimited. How key is the pro side of things from the to get yourself for ready for 28 in the Olympics?
I think anytime we can compete at a high level is great. And whether that's Athletes Unlimited or overseas in Japan or with national teams or with whatever pro league is coming up next, then I think it's going to add value to the athlete's career. I do wish that the pro softball world could work together in some sense and be able to support and complement one another versus fighting against one another, which I think has historically happened a lot in softball. But with what we have right now and how things are set up and evolving, I think anytime an athlete can get more high level competition, they're putting themselves in a space to improve.
When you watch college softball today, you've been away from it now as a coach since what, 2019, 2020 range, right? When you watch the college game today, what pops in your mind?
Ooh, I think it's getting more and more and more competitive, and I think the rich are getting richer. The big teams from the Power Five, with the addition of name, image, likeness, I think you can see how that's affecting the game, how that's affecting the recruiting game. I think it makes me appreciate not having to be on the recruiting trail battling that battle. And really, when I reflect deeply on it, it makes me want to support those student athletes even more because I know the challenges of the name, image, likeness, the comparison, the social media, all of those other factors that are now impacting these athletes who love the game and just want to play the game. And there's so much other noise going on. It motivates me to do what I'm doing at the highest level I can.
It's wild. Realignment also playing an impact. So, I mean, there's a lot of, it's just a lot of changes in the sport, which is kind of wild. And yet, what's kind of cool is you got programs like Boston, who is competing still at a high level, ranked in the top 25 as we're talking. You competed against Ashley Waters in Boston when you were at Bucknell. Does that make you kind of marvel there at what they're accomplishing? Because you were at head to head competing for the NCAAs when you were there. You were coach of the year. But you're right. It seems like there's a gap in college athletics from the big schools and the smaller schools, but yet schools like Boston are kind of, if you want to say, defying the odds or whatever you want to describe it, are showing they can still compete despite maybe the advantages that the bigger programs have.
Absolutely, yes. And I think so much respect for Ashley Waters. She's created an amazing program there. I always enjoyed competing against her. And I think had I remained in the Patriot League, we would have had a great run there, battling back and forth for the top spot. But cheers to her for the program that she's created and to be able to be ranked top 25. That's incredible. And I think an anomaly for sure. Moving forward, we'll likely see that less and less. But I think for those programs who have put together a system from every facet, checked off every box, and not just to check it off, but actually to build something amazing, there is still opportunity to compete.
Is there any part of the game, college game, you like them to address? There's been a lot of stuff addressed. Pitch clocks have been added, batter's box, obstruction, everything. I know when you used to come on, when we come on the show, you were at Bucknell, you talked about the recruiting cycle and things like that. So you've always had a lot of the thoughts about the college game. Now seeing it from the outside, what jumps out at you? Think there maybe there's some things they have to either address, either for to fix, or maybe some things that you think should be highlighted more?
I think the addition of the pitch clock, I think, is great. Obviously, having been in the international game for so long, it became just part of the game. So I think that's a transition that won't be even talked about after the next year or so. And I think we're seeing more and more staffs. I think of Washington, their staff being filled with alums and with more young women coming up. And at the same time, female coaches are leaving coaching at a higher rate than men. And so I think that would be the area that I'd like to see some added focus. I think We Coach is an organization that puts a lot of resources into attracting and maintaining female coaches in the world of coaching. And so I'm proud to be a part of their organization and to continue pouring into the female coaches. So that's kind of where my brain's at right now. How can we continue to empower these women who are graduating to be interested in coaching and to give it a go and then to sustain a career in coaching?
That's interesting. I didn't know that more females are leaving the coaching than male. What's that about? Is there a theory behind that? Especially now, this is the first year we're adding a third full-time paying assistant, which should create more opportunities across the board. But I did not know that. Kind of expand on that because that caught me off guard a little bit.
I think if we're, this is my own personal opinion, if we think about just the biases that we have as human beings, female coaches are graded more challengingly than male coaches are by their athletes. And especially when you have female athletes who are reviewing and judging female coaches, it's incredible the stats on how much tougher females are when grading other females who are overseeing them. And so I think there's more scrutiny, there's more judgment, there's higher expectations, and we're just as females viewed so differently in society that a strong, confident woman comes across as an ass, and a strong, confident man comes across as a good leader. And so I think there's still that gap in society that chips away at women in coaching.
But that's interesting. You're telling me women are grading the fellow women coaches harder. So it's almost like there's like this infighting. And I don't know if that's the proper words to describe it. But that's the part that fascinates me a little bit, is that it's really within. It's not like that. Wow, you caught me off guard. See, this is why you got to come on more often. See, this is what happens. We always, folks, now this is what me and Joey get into these conversations and just ramble on. But that's fascinating to me. I've never heard that before.
Yes, it is incredible. The number of female head coaches that I've had conversations with that will eventually come to open up about the feedback they're getting from their student athletes. And when I'm able to reassure them that I hear this across the board from female head coaches, that they are getting these bad reviews from their players because the standards are so high for them, or they're viewed a little bit differently than their male counterparts, and how much a relief that is for those coaches. And so for any female coaches out there who are listening to this, if you are getting challenging feedback from your players, know that it is normal.
Wow, I've learned something new here. That's incredible. It's partly because you think they hold them to a higher standard. Is that, hey, you're one of us? Like, you should be able to relate with me more. Why are you being so hard on me? Is that part of it? Like, I'm fascinated by that. Wow.
I think
Wow.
a lot of it is the societal bias of how we view females. And often to be a strong, confident person, it looks out of the norm. It looks, out of the norm of what females are supposed to be. And so the how we are received is different than, for generations, men have been the leaders. They have been in these positions. They have been the voice of authority. And so we are all used to hearing that voice. And I learned about bias through some of my classes, having majored in psychology and then being intrigued by it. And I was sitting in a course just a few years ago when I was coaching at Bucknell. They offered this lunch and learn kind of thing for investing and for being ready for retirement kind of thing. And there were two instructors for the course, one guy, one woman. And I found myself listening more intently to the man, and I was aware of it. I noticed it. And so I was like, all right, Joey, there's the bias. Now, when the woman's speaking, pay just as much of attention to her and value her word the same. But until we realize and recognize that the bias exists, it's really, really tough to battle.
I took minored in psychology, so I know what you're talking about. And there's a lot of biasness in general we could get into, but we're not going to do that because you've got things to do on that. But that's fascinating. Thank you for sharing that. That's fascinating to me. We're definitely going to talk about that more down the road as we talk. But I'll give you a couple more things. I know you got to get going. I want you to talk about Jen Salling, Victoria Haywood, Kaylee Rafter's doing coaching, Danielle Laurie's doing commentary, just your teammates who are still involved in the sport, even though they're not playing, and that impact that they're having, and you being able to follow them.
Yes, it is. I mean, it makes the game so much more fun for me when I can pop up to Clearwater and watch my teammates leading other teams and impacting those athletes. And it is so cool. And current athletes too, Sarah Groenewegen coaching and watching her. And I chatted with her after a game and just said, I can tell you're in your element. I asked her how she was doing. I didn't need to because I could see it. I could see how much she was enjoying being out there pouring into other athletes. And especially for those athletes who are still playing, to be able to do that. And it's incredible how much you develop as an athlete through coaching. And for my retired teammates as well, who are still in the game, it's such a joy to watch. Kaylee Rafter is the most brilliant softball mind I've ever seen in my life. And just watching her from the sidelines, chatting with her hitters before they're going up to the plate, or, you know, working with them and pouring into them and understanding how her brain works. It's just so cool to see in action.
It is. It's certainly a lot of fun, and we'll see how they're all doing throughout their college season. So I'm sure we will cross paths at some point during the season. But in the meantime, hey, it was good to talk to you about a lot of subjects. I think it was fascinating conversation that I think opened up a lot of eyes here and get some people to talk to think about some things of many different aspects. Joey, you're doing some great stuff. Tell the audience one more time where they can follow you and what you got coming up.
Absolutely. Yes. Joey-Lye.com is my website, and across all socials, Joey, the number one, Y-E. Someone had taken Joey Lye. So the L is a number one, and that's where you'll find me. And I'm also working on a book about mindset and mental performance. So I'm excited to dive more into that.
Is there a timetable for this book?
I'm motivated to see if I can get it done this year. Seeing that it is an Olympic year, it's exciting to see if I can get that pushed out. But there's a lot more depth to book writing than one anticipates. So, that's what I'm saying. This year, let's go.
All right. No pressure. Whenever that book comes out, we'll have to get you back on to talk about the book and the process of writing that book. I'm looking forward to that. And in the meantime, it was great to catch up with you in Clearwater. Hopefully you cross paths. You know some people in Orlando, in case you ever want to come down for a game or two. But hey, thanks for taking the time. I know you got so many things going on right now, busy schedule, but to take the time to talk to me and talk back on the podcast, really enjoying what you're doing overall. And thanks for doing what you're doing to the game. And thanks for talking to us.
Thank you, Eric. I always appreciate our time together and what you do to support the game of softball. So thank you.
And thanks again to Joey Lye for joining us here on In the Circle on D1 Softball. That'll do it for this busy edition of In the Circle on D1 Softball. Victor will be back in the next episode. Of course, he had to help translate, edit, and produce the show as always. Thanks to Justin McLeod for joining us from Austin, Texas, covering Oklahoma, Texas. Thanks to Ryan Potke covering the Georgia-Tennessee series in Knoxville, Tennessee. Keep us up on D1Softball.com for all the latest news, the very best coverage you're going to get in college softball. So, for the entire staff, for Vic, I'm Eric Lopez. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of In the Circle on D1 Softball. Good night, America. May you hope you finish your story.